Welcome back, everybody, to another wonderful, spectacular, rural, social distancing episode of the Be Better Podcast. Coach Chris here, and I am still in my seclusion in an undisclosed place, very close to the Canadian border, listening to loons and ducks and wrangling my kids every day. But I grabbed a good friend of mine who I'm calling from a different time zone, just because, you know, why not? And I got him on the phone because we're distancing and that's how we roll. I have Mark Sortino from Team MPI on the phone. Mark, welcome to the Be Better Podcast.
Hey, Chris. Stoked to be here.
Oh, I'm glad to have you. So a little bit of background on Mark, because I know he's not one to like to toot his own horn. So I'm just going to give you a couple of toots on the proverbial horn here. Mark is a head coach and CEO and co-founder at Team MPI. He's a level 3 USAT coach. He was the 2016 Para Coach of the Year. Dun, 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 dun. And he also was a 2016 Para Head Coach for the Rio Paralympic team. And a fun fact that I think that is always fun to throw out is that Mark has 20 years of service in the U.S. Navy as a naval flight officer. Between you and Brian, I'm not sure who's cooler, but that just seriously going to just toss that out.
I am, because I'm Navy. Yeah.
So. What is it? Go Army, or no? Go Navy, beat Army. Is that what it is?
That's correct. Okay. Yes. Just, yes. And beat Air Force.
And
yes.
Beat Air Force. So. I just have to know exactly what the right terminology is, so I don't fumble. But you're also a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, which is and so thank you very much for your service. Let's just get that out there.
Oh, thanks, Chris.
So Mark, you and I have known each other for a while, more recently, because I put it out there that Mark's one of my mentors, and that means that he's helping me be better, to, you know, kind of put the tagline in there, which I very much appreciate. And so it has allowed me to spend more time with you, which I appreciate. But Mark, for people that don't know, give a little bit of information on how you came to triathlon coaching from the U.S. Naval Academy.
You know, I grew up in New England. I was a Northwest Connecticut kid, so a lot of snow, shoveling off ponds to play hockey. Back when, I'm an old guy now, so back when, in those days, you played three or four sports a year. You know, you had a fall, winter, spring, and then when you're out of school, a summer. And so I was just always active and outdoors. And that happened, continued through high school at a pretty high level. And then I went to Naval Academy and did more club sports. And then once I got into flying for the Navy and the fleet and all that, I sort of went away from doing a lot of sports, and especially organized sports. I was minimally active. And then, like a lot of people that we coach or have coached, somewhere in my mid-30s, I felt this pull to be active once again, to rediscover my athletic self. And the short of the story is, a friend of mine in the squadron was selling a bike, and he said, would you like one? And I had like a cruiser that we had just gotten, that I was just biking around for the first time. Yep. In the neighborhood. And I said, sure. And I went over and looked at it, and it was a soft ride beam triathlon bike, and I thought it was the coolest looking thing ever.
Those were the coolest things at the time.
And I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. And he says, yeah, just go ride it for a little, you know, hold on to it for a couple weeks, and then I'll sell it to you if you're interested. Well, little did I know, I couldn't ride it, because I had to get pedals, I had to get shoes, I had to get a helmet. I already had a helmet, and I didn't even know. The only thing I knew about triathlon was Ironman, which I had watched.
Yeah.
Every year, and I've watched, I mean, it was a very emotional experience for me, even though I had no, that's all I knew what triathlon was Ironman, long course. And one thing led to another, and that was my introduction. Of course, I found out about triathlons. I found out that they had sprint triathlons. They were I was in Florida at the time. They were all over the place. And that sort of got into my athletic journey into triathlon.
Gotcha. And so being from that area, did you resonate with any of, because I'm assuming this is probably what? This is mid, late 80s?
No, this is much later. This was early 2000s.
Okay, early 2000s. So
yeah.
Was like the Karen Smyers of the world, were they kind of in your in your sights at that point in time? Were they, like, did, since they were kind of from that area, big names and kind of big recognizable long course names in that area?
To be honest with you, it was less regional notoriety that I was sort of knowledgeable about. It was more national and global, just because I started diving into it. And, for me, watching, at that time, internet started really developing. I was able to look at a lot of video and watch the old Iron War and all these. Then I discovered the old Bud Light series in the 80s. And I started reading, I started watching, ITU. And so it was really that time frame that I started following all the big names. And then those that came before him, Dave Scott, Mark Allen.
So Pig, more around the Tim DeBoom era.
Yes. Tim DeBoom, I followed currently. That's absolutely correct. Yep.
Yeah. That was such a cool and little known fact, last American to win at Kona.
Yes.
Which is crazy and in fact, to think about.
His time was not fast comparatively to many other years. But Tim persevered on a day when so many others failed. It was just a great win for him.
Yeah.
And for the U.S.
Both years.
In my opinion. Yeah.
And I remember the battles that he went through with Peter Reed at the time. It just was that they were kind of like the Dave Scott, Mark Allen pair. Rule out the Heinriegels and the Stadlers and all those guys.
Yep. I remember watching the Stad. Yeah, all those. It was just great. Maca was coming up.
Wasn't he an arrogant SOB when he first started?
he really was. But there's something here. Here's what I'll say. I was always attracted to the Bjorn Borg. This is my age versus McEnroe. I like the quiet sage athlete who was outstanding. It's kind of like motor vehicles. I loved the German fast cars that just sort of hummed versus the American muscle cars that were super loud.
Yeah.
And that was how I liked it. But there's something about Macca which I loved. And what I loved about him, he was fearless. Okay. And he was not afraid to fail.
Yep.
And it's something that I've always started, I took in and then I brought it both to my personal athletic adult adventures, along with elite athletes I work with, both age group and pros. And it's this idea that don't be afraid to fail, right? And it's okay to shout to the world what your goals are, okay? And that's what Macca always did. He always just put it out there and he wasn't afraid to fail. And I think it's a wonderful lesson for a lot of pros out there.
It's funny because I think he caught a lot of flack for that because our sport is completely different. Triathlon is completely different than any other sport. Being pompous, being arrogant is so frowned upon. We're so, the Craig Alexanders, the stoic, quiet gentlemen, they're the ones that we seem to be just like populated with. But, with Macca, he did. That was the thing. He was so arrogant and so loud. Like, I would have won if I hadn't dropped out. Like, what? Like, nobody says that. Like when he got in the fight afterwards at the discotheque with Stadler and like, when is the last time you heard about a triathlon fight? And what would that ever look
Macca,
like?
And maybe your listeners can correct me. Maybe you can, but I believe Macca is still the heaviest Ironman winner on record. I think he was like 172.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you hang out with Macca, he is a physical force. He looks like a world-class professional athlete. When you hang out with a Crowe or somebody smaller who weighs 20 plus pounds less, maybe 30 pounds less, it's just a different feeling. So, Macca getting in a fight, I think I could see that.
totally. He definitely had a different build. And I think, somebody will call us out on weight and they'll probably put Peter Reed out there.
I'm probably wrong on that.
Well, I'm sure Peter Reed, even though Peter Reed had a huge eating disorder and was thin as a rail, being, I think it was 6'5", he probably
had some
weight.
Same with Chris Lieto. I think Chris was somewhere in his 150s, because they were really, really,
super lean. Oh, weight, almost, yeah, almost too
even
lean.
Though Chris was so fast on the bike, you know, he's probably one of the fastest Americans on the bike.
Yeah, so they were super lean.
Up until maybe 5-8 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, so. I do miss Macca in our sport, though. I mean, he's still out there, and he's still a bit of a presence. But my first time meeting him was at Lifetime when he raced the Lifetime Fitness Triathlon in Minneapolis, and something happened. Oh, the seat broke off his bike, and he pulled a pin like in T2. And it was raining, and he took the disc off the back of his bike and used it as an umbrella. And I remember as a new triathlete, I thought, this guy is the coolest human being ever to walk the planet.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you can make a really good argument that Macca's the greatest male triathlete, today, at least top five.
Still
he
today?
He has done it at... No, not currently, but even with the history of triathlon, the short history of triathlon, if you look at Macca's record, short to long, everything that he's accomplished, it's remarkable. It's truly remarkable. And, the fact that he went back post Ironman days to try to get into the Olympics and triathlon, racing against all these guys, that was a little bit of a humble pie for him, but he did much better than I thought he would ever do, finishing in the, I think his highest finish was probably in the 20s at ITU, which still,
it's still a tough game.
Yeah. He may have actually gotten higher a few times. He just couldn't run.
Yeah.
He couldn't run with, he couldn't run a 29 or 29:30. So
that's such a sad thing.
But who knows? I may be all off on that. Again, I'm not attracted to the cocky guys like that, but I just loved how he put it all out there. And then he wasn't afraid to fail.
Yeah.
And to publicly fail.
Yep.
Which I think can be for most pros an asset. Okay. Because when you're afraid to fail publicly, I think it inhibits your performance immensely, or has the potential to do that.
Yeah.
So
I agree. And that's one thing I've told, like when I've coached, like professional athletes and athletes who are on the higher end of the age group range, and you begin to shift from the physicality of training to the mental training of an athlete, and having them kind of have that winner's mindset. And I've always like come back to one main question and said, what's going through your mind when you toe the line at any race? Is it, I don't care who's next to you. Is there any times that you think, oh well, there's no way I can beat that guy? Because there are many times they come back. Yeah. They're so strong and I've always lost to them.
Yeah.
So, I'm looking somewhere else. Like, I'm going to beat this guy. And I said, if you don't stand the line and go, I can win this, you'll never win. Yeah. Like, you never will. You have to believe that if you don't believe in yourself, no one else will. And that you have to have that belief to be able to go into that next level of achievement, because that's where it really does come from. And I remember listening to Mark Allen say at one cheesy moment in a movie, and I can't remember what the name of the movie was, but he said that if you tested the athletes at the beginning of Kona, the pros, from a biomechanics standpoint, physiology standpoint, they're all within like 0.1% of each other. They're all like, they're tip top, but what separates them? And he points to his head and he points to his heart. Those are the two things that separate athletes at that level. And that's the hardest thing sometimes to teach. And going back to Macca, he had that, there's a difference between being cocky and confident. And I think he really rode that line very well. And I think people wrote him off as cocky because our sport does not have anyone in that kind of like wheelhouse that he has, that he drove into.
Yep. Yep.
So good. Great. Times. Good stuff, Mark. Good stuff. Mark, I'm going to totally take a 180 here. You are the owner of a sweet travel van now, aren't you?
I am.
and that travel van has allowed you to correct me if I'm wrong, but that's your only mode of transportation, is that correct?
It is, yeah. So my wife and I, we live in Boise, Idaho, which means as short as 30 minutes, we're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And an hour, we're really in the middle of nowhere. We've thought about this idea of getting a conversion van. Didn't know anything about it, knew there were tons of money. We're like, wow, we don't have that kind of money. We had one car. It was a Subaru, which is very common up here. And my wife works out of the home, and so do I, obviously, as a coach. And so one car was fine. We met somebody who had a van from a company called conversion company called Van Do It, out of Kansas City, Missouri. And plug. Yes. We're like, wow, this would be great down the road. One thing led to another with our conversation over the next 6 months with a rep who said, you know what, you guys would be great. There's nobody from that company in your whole area, blah, blah, blah. You could, you know, rep these on the side and show them to people and go to, you know, conventions. And I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. Let's do it. So we went down the process, got the van last August. As soon as we got the van, we sold the Subaru, and it's a Ford Transit 350, solar, you know, hydraulic bed, a slide rear cargo tray. So we throw our mountain bikes in there. We throw our SUPs in there. We throw our skis in the winter. Since August, we spent probably 35 days wow. sleeping in that thing, from California, Oregon, Idaho, Utah, Arizona. I mean, just all over the place. So yeah, it's honestly been life changing. It really is the coolest thing. And now, a little side note, our youngest kid is finishing up her sophomore year in college.
Okay.
And then we have two olders that are already graduated college. So we have the ability pretty easily, you know, one little dog.
There you go. So you don't have a Great Dane. You don't have 16 kids. You're not the Partridge Family touring in the family bus.
No.
And so it's easy to space out. Because I would think that there have to be challenges that you overcome in owning and living in a van for an extended period of time. And I would say extended for, you know, probably over a week.
Yeah, we've done, I think, Chris, the longest we've done is either 6 or 7 days.
Okay.
It's really seasonal, with challenges. So the summer, we have a little shower in the back, so we can always shower and, take care of ourselves, as far as cleaning and everything else. In the winter, when you start camping more than a few days, yeah, showering becomes a little bit of an issue. We don't have a shower inside the van. But really it's about water, right?
Yeah.
But with water's the main thing. We've done quite a bit of urban camping, and that's just parking your van in a city on the side road.
Yeah.
Or at a trailhead in a city I forget what they call it in the van life movement, but it's sort of incognito. You know, you don't look like a camper van. You just park. There's no light coming out. You have all your shades in there. Curtains in the front, behind the front seat. So it looks like just sort of a van.
Yeah, you're not putting you're not putting lawn chairs out with the jarts.
Yeah.
And the hibachi.
You're just sleeping downtown. And we've done that quite a bit, which is totally different. So yeah, it's seasonal. We don't have any plans of living in a van permanently.
Down by the river with some government cheese.
Right, right. But we do have plans on, you know, doing more of these week-long trips. And here's the crazy thing. You know, the advantages now and the speeds of cell phone data is so incredible. We have a booster that we just put on the van, you know, a cell booster we put on the van, little tiny antenna with plugged into our battery bank, and it boosts our signal, and we're able to work on the road.
Yeah.
We're able to stream. So people are like, oh, I love my Netflix or I love my HBO, whatever it is. You can stream anything you want. We just throw an Apple TV puck in there, and that's all our apps, and run that through the cell phone. So it's crazy.
I can imagine that, because when you say conversion van, my mind goes back to, like, you know, the 1984 Chevy van with the couch that folded down to a bed in the back. You know, if you were lucky, you had a VCR with a TV in it. Had like the kind of disco lights around the top with like wood trim, But the technology today, I mean, you've got like, you know, I think with lithium batteries, with, like you said, internet capability, with all the different adaptations that are out there now, these things really can get dialed into you individually.
Totally individually. And now totally affordable. It's not just, so when I say affordable in a van world, I'm talking anywhere from, including the van, $60,000, $100,000. And you get RV loans for that, which means that you can, instead of a 7-year loan like you would max out on a car, you can get a 10, 12, or 15-year loan.
Oh, yeah.
So now the car payments become, I mean, the van payments become just like a car. And these vans, we're not talking an RV. We're talking about a van.
Yep.
A van, they drive like a car.
Yep.
So we, listen, I park at Trader Joe's all the time. And anybody who's parked at Trader Joe's, no matter where the Trader Joe's is, it's a tiny parking lot. And it's very crowded. And it's a little stressful just finding a parking space. And
it's made for Priuses.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, it is. And it's just wonderful. It honestly was just a life changer. So we went down to Ironman, Arizona, had a company. We were doing a coaches retreat. For guest coaches there that registered, we did all day presentations and CEUs. And then, that was a Friday, and then prepped athletes that we had there Saturday for the race on Sunday. We had the van parked out on the run course, blaring music at all hours of the night and, into the very end, and then slept in the van right there, you know, and it was awesome. So, it's a great for a coach going to different races and events. I do that at mountain bike races up here in the mountains and everything else. It's really been fun. We're very fortunate. I'm super stoked we did it.
Yeah. I mean, financially, it makes a lot of sense. And from a business standpoint, it makes a ton of sense. I've seen them out there. I mean, I personally can't pull one off right now, but I've toyed with the idea. And like you said, the ability to go to different locations, the ability to, to essentially use it for multiple purposes, it makes it super versatile. And I could see it being a huge asset for you.
I think we're going to see more and more of it, Chris, as we get older. It's just, the ability to go off and be in the middle of nowhere in nature. It's just, and you don't, everybody has different needs, whether it's a van, an RV, any type of camper, it's all different needs. But I will tell you, these particular vans that you can drive on a regular daily basis, as a passenger van, a cargo van, and a camper van all in one, they're the future of a lot of this stuff for both families and couples and individuals.
So. Yeah, I've got one athlete who's actually waiting to receive theirs. He's a he's a gravel rider. And so he has one daughter who is, I think she's 12. And so they do a lot of trips to national parks in the summer. A lot of camping and extended periods. And it really does make it more, I think, just maybe more feasible to do some of those things. And especially if you're going to events, if you think of it, like I would think of it as, I mean, there's not a lot of money in short course racing anymore, but if from a pro standpoint, it could be a huge advantage to cut down on transportation costs, lodging, all that. Plus, you can make a training camp wherever you want.
Yep, that's 100% correct.
Nah, that's great. I got to rethink this whole thing. I'm in the middle of building a bunkhouse and a workshop up here, kind of like a new Yankee workshop. So,
well, good. You got a place I can park my van?
Yeah, I do. You can come up here and we can go take it. Bring your stand up paddleboards or your SUPs with you because we got lots of water out here. But it's super cold right now. It's like
I won't come now.
No, the water is 49 degrees, and I don't know about you, but I've been trying to get athletes to go into the open water. And they are just, I've only had one person who's risked going for an open water swim here in Minnesota right now.
That's cold.
A lot of hard no's, a lot of hard passes. And, I don't know if do you know a guy named Dave Cameron?
The name sounds familiar.
So he is big with, what is it? It's total immersion. So he's a big total immersion guy nationally from here. Big swim coach. But anyways, his claim to fame is he swims pretty much in anything. you know, he's like a walrus. He can swim in any temperature of water. So he was pimping me the other day. He's like, come on, the water's definitely, ice is off. You can go swimming now. And I'm like, that is not my threshold. Like, the ice leaving the lake is not my threshold for when I'm going to jump back in.
No, it's not mine either.
This is where I would do much better, like near an ocean or in southern states versus where we're at.
Yeah.
It's very tough. So do you get to fly much anymore?
No. I didn't opt to continue flying.
Do you miss it?
Basically when I get out. You know, I do miss it a little bit. I did so much of it for so long. It's interesting the way as you get older, you start to look back on your life and you're like, why did I do this? Or why did I feel this way? And I seem to, at least currently, come to the realization that when I transition to another phase in my life, I turn that page in the chapter and I don't look back.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, so I don't really spend a lot of time. And now, you know, I'm 53 and we have our 30th reunion for the Naval Academy coming up. I hadn't been back since I graduated, if you can believe it or not.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I have all these close friends that are now reconnecting all year through all these media venues. And I'm remembering all this stuff.
Yeah.
So that's the only time I really rely on a lot of my friends to bring me back to those days, because I forgot so much of it.
Yeah, you know,
it was great.
Flying has always been one of my things that I've put on my life list. My wife bought me an experience a couple years back for my birthday where I got to go up and, you know, the guy kind of takes you up in a little Cessna. You get to fly it around a little bit and all that kind of stuff. And I'm totally like, we live next to an airport. I watch airplanes all day long when I'm at home. On the lake here, we got a couple of float planes down the shore from us, and we were watching last night. Guys are doing touch and goes, practicing. But, you know, along your van line, at one point in my life, I had actually specced out what it would be like to sell my house, learn how to fly, buy an old Grumman Mallard, and basically live out of that for the rest of my life.
That's great. That's great.
Like, if you remember what those old Grumman Mallards were, they were Jimmy Buffett had one, and I think that's maybe what it was. But I thought it's like it's a van on the water that can fly.
Yeah.
And I thought for this, like all these different things, and then but then you know having kids and like you know a real job. I was a cop at the time. It was completely you know I didn't have any place to land. You know. Near the cop station and you're sure not going to buy a Grumman Mallard, you know, with a cop salary. But that had always been one of my things that I thought, you know what, someday I will. And it probably never happened, but I'm always fascinated by people that know how to fly, have flown and, have been in that. And I always think that it's such a neat, different experience and perspective, but
it is.
But 30 years, that's gotta be, Are you a little nervous about it, or is there any trepidation going back at all?
No, not at all. I was moving so fast at the time. The Naval Academy was really hard for me. It was extremely challenging academically, and I came from a very hard high school. I'm just not that smart a guy, and I had to work so hard there. So we graduated with 150 hours, not 120. So it was constantly we were carrying anywhere from 19, 20 credit hours a semester, as high as 21, I think. Wow. And so when I left there, I was done and then jumped into Naval Aviation, which was fantastic. And basically, Naval Aviation was lots of flying, lots of independence. You are the captain of your ship, incredible, you know, teaching and it was just phenomenal. But there was also, when you weren't flying, we didn't have a lot of guys doing triathlons. We had their triathlon for a naval aviator back then was eat breakfast, drink, eat dinner, drink, you know? So that was what was preoccupied. If I wasn't flying, I was having a good time.
So I have two questions on this line. Number one, what was your call sign?
My call sign was Beavis.
Beavis?
Yes. So okay. it was very close to getting Butthead. I mean, honestly, it was a vote, and I got Beavis.
Was it the curly hair? Did that do it?
Well, I arrived at the fleet squadron with a friend of mine. There were two of us arrived, and Beavis and Butthead was huge at that time. And And basically the Navy, Naval Aviation, you don't choose your call sign.
Yeah.
Okay. If you like a call sign, you're guaranteed never to be called that. So you come, they get your call sign either by something stupid you've done or making fun of your name. And that's kind of it. Okay. And, so when we got together, the other senior junior officers, that's sounds counterintuitive, but the junior officers who had been in the squadron for a year or more kind of ran the squadron, and they, it's all harassment. And they said, look, you guys are going to give a poem in 2 months and we're going to, you know, call it, we're going to determine who's Beavis and who's Butthead. And, now what happens when you get that call sign? Okay. It doesn't change. And that's your call sign that you wear on your name tag. Okay. Oh. And that's the call sign that gets painted on the aircraft. Oh. That's your call sign for your career, yes. Essentially, unless you do something really, really, really stupid that we can make fun of you. Okay. And then they'll redo it. But that's kind of,
did you have Beavis like the character on your helmet?
I didn't do, no, we were limited to what graphics we can put on the helmet. We can only put the squadron graphics on the helmet. Okay. So I had Beavis, you know, Beavis coffee cups and
nice.
Beavis name tags, Beavis on all the uniforms stuff, you know, leather jackets.
This is going to be my new favorite fact about you. This is my new favorite fact. All right. Second,
there's some great call signs.
Second question. When was the last time you played shirtless volleyball in jeans?
That was a lot. No.
In your aviators.
I have done that. I didn't wear dog tags. So essentially,
you know what I'm referring to, summer, right?
Yeah. The summer that Top Gun came out was 1986. And that was the summer that it literally came out right before I went to the Naval Academy for the summer to get yelled at for 2.5 months before I started my plebe year. And so we all, you know, thought that was really funny, and it was the greatest recruitment tool, for the Navy and Naval Aviation. But part of the reason that actually occurs, that scenario, is because naval bases are on beaches,
yep.
You know, they're all over on the coast everywhere. And sure enough, that's all I did was play volleyball down in Pensacola through most of my flight training. And, you know, we were playing little tournaments. I was on the beach all the time. If I wasn't flying or studying, I was on the beach. So
it's totally true.
I don't know what the kids are doing now, but we played a lot of volleyball. And, once you get to your fleet squadron, you're pretty much, you know, you're deploying and war fighting and all that stuff. So.
Oh yeah. Well, I love that movie. I can probably recite it front to back. My family hates when I watch it. I actually got to see, I did a paracamp, in Chula, 2 years ago,
uh-huh.
2 years ago. I think uh-huh. It was 2 years ago. And I, and Wes Johnson and I were leading a bike ride, and I made everybody stop, 'cause we rode by the Top Gun house. And I was like, oh my God, everybody stop. And they're like, what? And I'm like, no, just stop. And just, do you know what this is? And they're like, no. And it was the house, you know, it's Kelly McGillis's house from Top Gun.
Yeah.
And it's actually like it's like a national monument now down there. And I just stood there like, you know, like a 13-year-old Chris staring at Wayne Gretzky still in his Oilers jersey. And I was like, oh my gosh, look at
yeah,
it.
Yeah. That's funny.
It was really good. So, one thing I don't want to miss out on is Team MPI. It's a large company, a large coaching company. You got a number of different coaches. Give me a little bit of background on how that came about and what makes Team MPI different from other coaching businesses out there, and how do you differentiate?
Well, you know, I got really heavy into competing in triathlon as an amateur. And right when I started I qualified, right when I first qualified for Kona, I was just putting in these long weekly hours. I was into it like so many crazy athletes that we know. And there was no bike fitter in our region. And I went out to Dan Enfield's place and got certified and started bike fitting out of a run shop, believe it or not, bought a fit bike. And I had started coaching a couple friends for Ironman. And that led to a friend of mine, really casual friend. I didn't know that well. I'd ridden in some group rides, approaching me and saying, "Hey, look, we got these investors that want to connect a fitness facility with a resort and run triathlon camps. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Sure." And literally within a couple months, we realized that they had no interest in starting a company. They wanted us to start a company. And we said, "Well, we want to be coaches." And the two of us got certified January of 2010 up at Colorado Springs and started Multisport Performance Institute. That's MPI. And that philosophy, and basically we spread the net wide. So over the next 3 years, we did every type of camp possible, locally on the road, Ironman camps, single day camps, multi-day camps. We put on kids races, standalone, close the roads, duathlons, triathlons for ages 7 to 15. So all your juniors, or I'm sorry, your youth, where we had 100 to 200 kids. We did adult super sprint races we put on, and we coached remotely. So we talked about it, but we didn't want to invest in a brick and mortar and be required to show up at a given time. We wanted to be mobile. And back then, the only place we could really meet people is, that had good internet were Starbucks,
Everybody's
and
little
so,
shop.
yeah. And so through that process, the what came out of that was this concept of working and collaborating amongst coaches, because myself and my business partner, for the first year, we co-coached. And so is this love of communicating with another coach and feedback. And that had dictated ultimately over the next, 10 years of adding other coaches in our company. And we have a very we our core philosophy is, as far as the coaching side, is there are no secrets to coaching. Nobody has a secret coaching. There's no secret workouts.
Really?
Yeah. And then the other thing is there's no such thing as absolutes. And it's kind of one of my pet peeves when I read a lot and hear a lot of other coaches, so a lot of celebrity coaches actually. And you must do this, you can never do that. And there's so much diversity in the athletic world amongst athletes that there really is. Everything is based on the individual. And so, we built this company and basically coached all ages. We didn't coach youth, although we did put on all those races. Never made money from them, and in fact, we handed those races off after 3 years, and they are still going today. They're run by nonprofits,
Oh, that's
which is
great.
cool. We never made money on them, and that's why we ultimately had to hand them off. And I think if you're a race director, every race director should have to put on a kids event.
Oh,
Because
yeah.
if you put on a kids event successfully and safely, you have thought of everything and your communication has been exceptionally clear, because it can't be anything else.
No.
And you put on a safe race, because you got an 8-year-old on a main road, right, on a
Yep.
bike.
Yep.
So it would make a lot of these race directors even better. But yeah, that I don't
Agreed.
want to keep talking, let you ask more questions. But yeah, that was sort of the genesis of it.
Well, that's great. And so, how many coaches do you currently have working? I don't want to say underneath you because that sounds very, elitist, but how
Yeah,
many?
not underneath, but yeah, we have 11 coaches. We've been as high as I think 16. So through the growth of the company, we just sort of added coaches. We didn't really have a process when we first started. We were like, "Hey, you're a nice person. This is our business model. Great, come on board." And through the years, we had coaches that we took on that never coached. They just got their certification.
Yep.
We really liked them, and we mentored them and brought them on. And over the course of time, they finally got their first athlete, and then they did really well. And where we are now is we just have a we have a lot of sort of standards and wickets to come on board our company. I mean, first and foremost, the coach, we've got to like the coach and be a good person,
Yep.
and they have to fit our culture and be willing to share anything and everything, and not just within Team MPI, but with other coaches
Yeah.
outside of Team MPI.
There's a
And so we picked up some wonderful people that were unable to stay with us because they couldn't run their own business, right? They
yeah.
couldn't get athletes, and they didn't know that at the time. So we've gotten a lot smarter.
It's it, we have there's a lot of parallels between those two things, and I you know I'm on my third business now, which is kind of like an evolution between, you know, of what I learned going along the way. But yeah, I think you and I are we have a lot of the same philosophy there, in the two companies, and it's and so I would guess in knowing how Final K has been affected, I would guess that MPI, especially since you guys are not tied to a brick and mortar, that which takes a lot of the risk and liability that you know gyms and such have incurred. You guys are probably doing okay at this point.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So today we're having this interview on the 6th of May, right, 2020. So right now we've been 6 weeks into pretty heavy change of life, you know, maybe in our seventh week through the coronavirus and COVID-19. And I was expecting Chris to lose, you know, 20-30% athletes. And we haven't even got close to that. And I think what we talked about as a group, as a staff was, you know, and you and I may have talked about this, but it's essentially you have athletes that are goal oriented that look, if I've got a race, I want to hire a coach, and that is my sole focus is on that race. And if you take that race away, that athlete basically says, well, I don't really need a coach. So
yep.
I don't have a race on there. And then you have athletes that, hey, look, they're making big sacrifices to pay for your coaching. And, you know, if their income gets upset, you know, that's a disposable income they run out of, and they just say, hey, I if my income starts getting adjusted even slightly, I gotta stop coaching. And then you have athletes that when the kids get sent home, you know, that somebody has to watch the kids. If you have one, two, three, four kids, you don't have time for yourself anymore. So we had some, you know, just a couple athletes that needed to take a break. And so all those potentially are suspect and during these just bizarre times of taking a break from coaching. But the ones that stayed on, I think most of them are lifestyle athletes. It's like, look, I don't know when the next race will be, but having a coach, this teammate of mine to help guide me physically, mentally, in my daily athletic and movement endeavors, you know, is an important part of my life and my lifestyle. And so those people, it didn't seem to blink an eye. So it's been really interesting to see all this.
It's eerily similar. The things that everything you said has been exactly what we've experienced. And it's, you know, it's the things that I thought had kept us safe or kept me safe as a coach were the diversification or the different silos of income. And it's been incredibly humbling to find out that a lot of those silos are tied into very similar things. So you take events out of it and wow, like now if you talk about event production, audio, announcing, like even just teaching, like I luckily did a level two a couple weeks back, but it was, you know, it was online, you know, doing camps. A lot of those things are very spring based, and you take those out and then you end up having to kind of lean back on what your keystone is. And that's the keystone for us. And for me, it's always been coaching. And so, it's trying times and everybody I think is doing fairly well with it, but, it's great to hear that you're okay. Mark, I don't want to skip any more of your time here, but you have been an amazing conversation. I love where we went and I love the things we got to chat about. If people want to get a hold of you, what is the best way to find and connect with you?
Well, you can always get all the information about Team MPI at teammpi.com. And then really just reach out to me at Mark, M-A-R-K, at teammpi.com. And of course, I'm on social media and stuff like that. Not as much as most, but I tend to lurk more than I post.
but you're not doing TikTok?
No, I'm not. And again, I'm 53. I don't even know how to do that. And the other part of it is I view social media like video gaming. I try to stay away from a lot of it because I could see myself spending, you know, getting sucked into that vortex.
Yeah, for sure.
Sure. That's really nice. Hey, I do want to ask you, Chris, a quick question. You know, what is your favorite dessert that's your total weakness that you can never say no to?
My favorite dessert? I would say cookies. And they are, they provide you with a couple of different things. Number one, if your house ever smells, just bake some cookies. It totally is the best candle in the world. But we have gotten cookies down to a science. So I taught my youngest son how to make cookies. And then instead of making like a ginormous batch, because I will eat them all. I'm glad my oldest daughter never was a Girl Scout. And I fear if when my youngest daughter, if she ever becomes a Girl Scout, because I will go to, it'll be Fat Chris all over again. It will be just terrible. But we will bake and then we'll make and freeze little balls of dough that are individual cookies. So at night for dessert, we'll pull out like say 4 or 5 little balls to make 4 or 5 fresh cookies. And so that has been my way of not becoming, you know, just a glutton. But cookies, like almost any type of cookie, and I'm talking like, you know, even like, you know, little, like the little lemon drop cookies or the peanut butter ones with the Hershey Kiss. Christmas time is definitely my kryptonite. I just can't control myself, especially when the cookie trays come out. But cookies are my...
That's so funny. I think probably I've just noticed during this time there's a lot more baking going on.
Yes.
And it's been challenging.
It has been. How about you? What about you?
I have no idea, by the way. I wasn't planning on asking you a question that just came to mind. I think it's because it's cookies, but ice cream's my number one. Like I ice cream. I'm just an ice cream guy. I'm an ice cream guy over a cake, over pie, or even over cookies, which I love, like you, cookies. But ice cream to me is...
So you and Tim Yount have a lot in common.
Ah.
Have you ever been to an event with him? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I appreciate you. I'd love to have you come back at some point in time on the other side. Can't wait to next time I get to see you in person. Everybody check out Team MPI. They're definitely one of the high end groups out there. They only do good things. The personality of it is definitely top end. And Mark, all the best to you moving forward into your van life, into your family. Thank you for being a part of the show.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's awesome to chat with you as always. And I wish you and your family just all the best. And stay safe, my brother.
Thank you very much. And everybody, that would do it for today for another great episode of the Be Better Podcast. Remember to follow us on Spotify, on iTunes. We've got some sweet swag out there that we still have. If you want to represent us with a t-shirt. But for now, we just ask that you guys be safe out there, do the smart thing, and be a little better next time.